The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, 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 all persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning. Mr. Holland, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and this is my first time doing a virtual argument. I just want to make sure, sir, if I may, that everyone can hear me.
Yes, very clear audio and video.
Thank you, sir. This is a matter, my name is Josh Howard from Gaiman, Howard & Zasitarsky in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I represent Trevor Soloff in this matter, where our goal is for you to vacate and remand the sentence. We believe the sentence was both procedurally and substantively unreasonable, but I also recognize that the court may be very interested as to why you could hear this matter in the first place. There was an appellate waiver in his plea agreement. And so I would speak to that first. Ultimately, our argument, Your Honor, is that the district court did not handle the plea hearing, and as a result, it came to be that the district court never actually accepted the plea agreement formally or properly, as we believe the law mandates and should mandate. Ultimately, that creates both harm for Mr. Soloff, but also the opportunity for this court then to review the procedural and substantive reasonableness of his sentence.
Diana Moss, can I just want to be sure you're not making any claim that your client didn't agree to the agreement?
We recognize that he voluntarily and knowingly entered the plea agreement, and we're not seeking to withdraw the plea.
Well, if that's the case, and we should do what you wish, but not find it substantively or procedurally unreasonable, but just find this one flaw, it would send it back, and the district court presumably would expressly adopt the plea agreement. So is there a purpose in doing that?
We believe there are arguments that the district court did not, which goes to our second and third arguments, Your Honor, the district court did not pay enough attention to. It's basically the substantive and procedural reasonableness of the sentence. We would like to give him a second chance to get that right.
Right, I understand that, and that's part of your argument here. But if we should conclude that the sentence was substantively and procedurally reasonable, but that the contention you make with respect to the judge directly and expressly adopting the plea agreement has merit, so we send it back just for that reason, the only remedy would be for the district court to expressly adopt the plea agreement. So what purpose would that have?
Your Honor, we would think that if you send it back, he would have to engage in re-sentencing defendant Soloff.
Okay.
Can I just follow up on that, counsel? Because this may be the same question, in which case I apologize. So if you just assume for a moment, hypothetically, I thought it was pretty ambiguous as to whether or not the district court actually accepted this plea or not. The premise of your brief seems to be that the remedy for that would be that we would declare this plea agreement non-binding, non-enforceable, so that the waiver would no longer bind your client. But, and maybe this is the same question Judge Motz is asking, if we thought it were ambiguous, why wouldn't we send it back and let the district court say one way or another whether it is accepting or rejecting the plea agreement?
We believe sending it back includes both as part and parcel whether or not he's accepting the plea agreement and then re-sentencing the defendant on the substantive and procedural merits.
Well, but the problem with that answer is that in answer to my first question, you said you made no claim that your client didn't enter a valid plea agreement. That isn't your claim at all. So if you've conceded that he entered into a valid plea agreement, I don't see why the district court would resentence.
Your Honor, we need to be clear about that. We believe that he knowingly and voluntarily entered the plea agreement. And as a result,
Mr. Howard, you need to repeat what you just said. Your words were gobbled for that about 5 seconds. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I want to be clear that we recognize that he knowingly and voluntarily attempted to enter a plea agreement, but that the district court never properly accepted it. And as such, he could be stuck in an asymmetrical scenario where the government has the benefits of the plea and he has none of the benefits that ran towards him. And as such, if it were to go back to the district court, we believe that he would then have to re-sentence him on the issues that we've raised as to procedural and substantive reasonableness.
But counsel, I don't think you quite followed Judge Mott's scenario to in question. The question is that if the substantive claims you make, procedural and substantive due process violations, if we resolve them saying that no, there were none, the question is, if it went back for remand, what could the district court do other than just reject or formally accept the plea agreement, since you have made no claim that there was any invalidity in the plea? That's the simple question. What could it do more? I know what you wanted to do, but are you saying you had the whole panoply, including the right to withdraw the plea if we sent it back for that narrow purpose? Do you have a right to withdraw? Let's take that question.
Your Honor, I don't know that we do after the Rule 11 colloquy with the magistrate judge in this matter to withdraw it, but it's just not been accepted by the district court, which is what empowers your court to review the substance and procedural reasonableness arguments.
Absolutely. And that window being open, if we dispose of it, and you hope not, unfavorable to your client, isn't the window closed to all respects other than just to formally accept the plea?
Your Honor, we believe that if the court has not accepted the plea formally, then it needs to re-sentence the defendant in full.
All right. Go ahead. You may proceed.
I'm sorry, because I am confused. Sorry, it's Judge Harris again. So what you're saying, if I understand right, is that right now the window is open. The waiver is not operative, so we could review this sentence. Is that, but if we were to affirm the sentence, we should still send it back and let the district court, and the district court would then either accept or reject the plea and also resentence?
I think the window
is, right?
I'm so sorry. The virtual thing, part of it is, there was a delay there. I did not mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, I was done.
We believe the window is open for you because of the frailties of the plea agreement not being accepted by the district court. We believe the window is open for you to examine the procedural and substantive reasonableness. And as such, you know, if you find errors there, as we hope you will, and we believe there are, then would have to do more than one thing. We would have to re-sentence for office full and pay attention to the argument that we feel we're not paying attention to under Blue and Ross.
Counsel, it's Diana Motz again. I guess I don't understand what the basis would be for such a procedure. For example, if we find a defect in a sentence that would require a court to look at the entire sentence, in other words, there are challenges to other parts of the sentence, we send it back. And the district court often will have the authority to look at the whole sentence. But you don't claim any defect to the other parts of the sentence except for this one. I mean, if you had said that I didn't enter the sentence and he got the wrong, I don't know, he got the wrong guideline range. But you don't say that. So what basis would we have? Your man has already said that he agrees with the sentence, the underlying sentence that was given. I just don't see what we could do for you.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I'm totally following your question. We don't agree with the sentence. We believe the judge paid too little attention to a number of mitigating factors.
But your man agreed to it back in the day. You told me that that was the first thing out of your mouth, that you didn't challenge anything but the lack of the district court to adopt the plea agreement formally.
I am sorry if I miscommunicated that. We don't deny his guilt or his guilty plea, and we don't seek to withdraw that.
Or that he signed a plea agreement.
He signed a plea agreement, which the court never accepted, which empowers you to examine the reasonableness, both procedurally and substantively, of the defendant. And we would hope that it would go back to the court for resentencing based on your examination of the procedural realities.
Well, Mr. Howell, let's put it this way. Do you agree that in this posture as the appellant, you were obliged to raise all questions about infirmities of the sentence now?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe we did.
No, I'm not right. You did. So if we resolve those in a way that's unfavorable to you, how do you get another bite at the apple for other issues of sentencing not raised?
Well, that's a fair question. And we believe that you have the power, because there's the threshold issue in this whole case. Could it be just the appeal, the whole appeal be dismissed because of the appellate waiver? Well, that's in the plea agreement that we believe was never accepted by this court. Your court has the ability to recognize it was not accepted by this court and then examine the procedural and substantive reason. And I'm terribly afraid I've not answered your question, but we process.
Okay. All right. You want to, unless there are other questions on this, you may want to get to some of your arguments for substantive and procedural unreasonableness.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to procedural unreasonableness, we think they're manifest. Ultimately, this was the defendant in the most difficult kind of case of child pornography, where he engaged in phenomenal and remarkable acts of rehabilitation, and they were elaborated at sentencing. He had basically on bail until he was indicted federally.
Counsel, I can't hear you. Okay. I couldn't hear that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'll lean in. I'm sorry if that makes my picture look even worse than I normally am.
No, you look great.
So this is a defendant that, while on state bond before the federal charges took over, had really committed his whole life to curing the pathology that was within it. This is not your everyday bank robbery or other case where the motivations are just greed or anger. It's something that can be cured or at least can be rehabilitated. And he had done so much. Fully articulated both in the brief, but also in the joint appendix, and the court gave that, we feel, very short trip, to an extent that violates Blue and Ross and other of your decisions that require the district court to make an individualized sentence. And it, as to also the enhancement to, for a using a computer further as a kind of attempt is now just absolutely antiquated. It's not entirely clear responded to that, but the government has noted in their brief that at some point the district judge said, well, some judges in some places were buried in. And that they may be correct, but they may not be correct about whether or not that was the district judge's response. And where it's not clear, we feel that that fails the standards of this court for an individualized sentencing analysis. And I see that my time is up, so I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions from the panel?
Thank you,
Mr. Howard. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Christine Fritz on behalf of the United States. Today, we're asking this panel to dismiss the defendant's appeal in its entirety. From the beginning, this federal prosecution had a negotiated resolution. The relevant terms of the plea agreement were reviewed by counsel, were reviewed by the magistrate judge during the Rule 11. The parties and the court acted in conformity with the plea agreement. And we believe that the record reflects that the court accepted the plea agreement, even if it never made an explicit statement that it had unconditionally done so. If, however, the defendant is correct that there was no plea agreement accepted, we don't believe that the remedy is excising the appellate waiver as the defendant requests. Either we would think that there should be a limited remand for clarification and further proceedings, or alternatively, if the defendant's position is that there is no plea agreement and that he is not bound by the appeal waiver that was explicitly reviewed by the magistrate judge, and he wants to be relieved of that obligation because in his opinion there's no plea agreement, then that should hold true for both parties. Now, we think that the record shows that the court accepted the plea agreement. Yes. When the court signed the plea agreement following the magistrate judge's Rule 11, the court added a condition subsequent saying that its acceptance of the plea agreement was deferred pending review of the PSR. The court reviewed the PSR, and it did not take the steps that Rule 11 outlines to explicitly reject the plea agreement. The PSR recounted the fact that the parties had entered into a plea agreement that negotiated the resolution of this case from up front. It detailed the impact the plea agreement had, and the court, without any objection from either party, adopted the PSR. Beyond that,
what is the Ms. Fritz? Good morning. Good to see you.
Yes. Good morning.
The court said conditionally approved final acceptance is deferred pending receipt of the PSR, and you just told us that the district court accepted the PSR. What language do we have that says that?
That the court accepted the PSR?
Yeah.
At the beginning of the sentencing hearing, the court asked the defendant and defense counsel whether it had received and reviewed the PSR. It also indicated that it was familiar with the PSR, and the court stated that it was adopting the PSR except as to matters disputed in the addendum, and confirmed that there continued to no longer be any matters disputed in the addendum. Beyond that, we also have the statement of reasons that reflects the district court's unconditional acceptance of the PSR.
Can you tell me, when did these various statements take place? I just thought this was a very odd thing to say, that final acceptance is deferred pending receipt of the PSR. So this statement was made before the district court had the PSR, right?
Correct.
Conditionally approved?
Yes.
Okay. And then a month later, what happened then?
And then at some point, obviously, after the Rule 11 and the defendant's guilty plea, the probation office undertakes its review of the PSR, and eventually there's the drafts exchange, and then the court does receive and review it prior to the sentencing hearing. And then I think what we have here are the court statements at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, obviously reflecting that it had received and reviewed the PSR. But I don't think that our argument doesn't rest simply on the references to the court's acceptance of the PSR. We just think that that is a piece of the evidence showing the totality of the circumstances that this was in fact accepted. Beyond that, during the court's sentencing explanation, we have the fact that the court highlighted that the defendant promptly accepted responsibility and pleaded guilty pursuant to a plea agreement. When the court was reviewing with the defendant his appellate rights, the court specifically stated, "You signed a plea agreement, and I believe based on the sentence you received, the appeal waiver would apply, but you can present what challenges you believe are appropriate to the appellate court." After the sentencing, the court implemented the restitution order, which references the plea agreement at least three times. And as I was reviewing and preparing for this, it occurred to me that I think the restitution order is actually pretty important to whether or not the court accepted this plea agreement, because if you'll notice, the criminal information covered one infant victim. And it is black letter law that you cannot award restitution to victims who are not victims of the count of conviction, absent a plea agreement and the defendant's acceptance of that term. Here, we have a restitution order where the court awarded restitution 12 different victims. And we know for a fact only one victim is covered in the criminal information. So when you look at all of this together, we think that it is absolutely clear that the district court accepted this plea agreement.
Can I ask a question? It's Judge Harris. So your colleague started by pointing out that the district court wasn't the one who did the Rule 11 colloquy in this case. There were two different people, sort of a division of labor. And I will say that that's what troubles me about the case, the possibility. I mean, I agree with you that there's nothing to suggest that the district court rejected this plea agreement, and it seemed to operate consistent with the plea agreement. But I worry that when you have two different people, stuff can fall through the cracks, and it's possible the district court just thought, I don't have to accept or reject it, it's already been done. The magistrate did it. And so that's my concern. And when he says, you know, you did enter into a plea agreement in light of your sentence, I believe that you've waived your right to appeal your sentence. The I believe sort of stuck out to me. Like, it's not obvious that he is doing sort of the careful read you would expect to be done in the process of actually accepting the plea agreement. So that's my concern, that there are two different people here. And when you bifurcate responsibility that way, there's the possibility that nobody gets around to actually doing the formal acceptance.
In response to that, I'd like to point out that the magistrate judge during the Rule 11 stated that it conditionally approved the plea agreement. And a couple of days actually lapse, after which the district court itself signs the plea agreement. And I would suggest that this indicates obviously that the district court reviewed and signed the plea agreement. There are times when a defendant may be able to argue that an appeal waiver, may be able to successfully argue that an appeal waiver does not apply for whatever reason. And I think that it is prudent for the district court to simply say, I believe that based on this sentence, that this would fall within the scope of the appeal waiver, as opposed to telling the defendant something that when challenges are presented to this court might not hold true. I think that the court's law repeatedly focuses on the totality of circumstances when deciding whether an appeal waiver is valid. And when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, we think the plea agreement was accepted and the appeal waiver was valid. It was discussed. It was discussed between the defendant and his counsel beforehand. He represented that he discussed the plea agreement. The magistrate judge reviewed the critical terms of the plea agreement. The magistrate judge read the entire appeal waiver into the record and said, "Do you understand this? Do you agree to this?" And we now have, even on appeal, it would seem to me that the defendant is not trying to get out of the plea agreement. He seems to want the plea agreement, but not want the appeal waiver that was discussed specifically. And our position,
I'm sorry, can I just ask you a question? If just assuming hypothetically, I thought it was ambiguous what happened here and whether the district court accepted the plea agreement or not. I want to know what you think would follow from that. Because I can imagine one rule might be, look, if it's ambiguous, you should probably just presume he accepted it because he didn't reject it. One rule, or you might say, well, if it's ambiguous, then I guess you can't enforce the agreement, but send it back right now to the district court before you reach the merits and let the district court clarify the ambiguity and say whether or not it's accepting the plea agreement. And then I guess another result might be, well, if it's ambiguous, don't enforce the plea waiver and go ahead and reach the merits.
If the court, I'm assuming based on your hypothetical that you have found that any other statements or conduct by the court still don't resolve your question.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I think then the appropriate thing at that juncture is to send it back for a limited remand for the district court to clarify, because the parties need to know whether they have an agreement or not. And I think it's very clear that the parties operated under the belief that this is a plea, this is an agreement between the two. Again, this from the beginning was a guilty plea to a criminal information. The parties negotiated the charge and everything else. So if the question is whether a plea agreement that is binding on both parties in all respects exists, I think then the appropriate thing to do, if at that juncture in time you're still left with questions, the appropriate thing to do is to send it back.
Ms. Chris, excuse me. Can I ask you, have you ever seen this in your court before, this conditionally approved? I've never seen this before. Final acceptance is deferred pending receipt of the PSR?
Yes, actually, for the district judge who handled this, for Judge Dever, it is generally his practice to wait until after review of the PSR to formally accept or reject the plea agreement, especially in cases where it is a plea agreement that agrees to dismiss or forego charges.
And then does he do something after that, after he receives the PSR? If this is his usual practice?
I think that normally I think that in most of the cases that I have seen of his early on during the Rule 11 or during the sentencing hearing, which isn't stated here, that the court does specifically say early on in the proceeding that the defendant did plead guilty pursuant to a plea agreement. So that this idea of the plea agreement is introduced up front. I think that it would be better practice. And in some of the cases that I noted in my Rule 11 or in my 28J letter, it would be better practice for it to be an explicit statement of I am now unconditionally accepting the PSR.
But it's your representation to us that this is his usual practice and he doesn't circle around and make a specific statement. Is that right?
It is my statement that his usual practice is to defer acceptance.
And without circling around at the end to say, I now adopt it.
Honestly, that particular issue hasn't come up frequently for me. This is only the first time I've had a defendant argue that the failure to make an explicit statement of accepting the plea agreement means that the plea agreement is ineffective or executory. I've not had cause to look at that.
I would think the government would be just as interested in knowing whether the plea agreement is actually effective as the defendant.
I would agree with you, and I can assure you that is being communicated within our office to try to make sure that we avoid this sort of scenario, this sort of argument.
Okay.
But again, for the purpose of this case, we think that all of the court's statements during and after the sentencing hearing, as well as its awarding restitution to victims beyond the count of conviction, all of this shows that the agreement was accepted. And I think also the party's conduct. Oh, yes, Judge Harris?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just had one question, and I may have been misremembering or have misunderstood the record, so set me straight if I'm wrong. But does the final judgment say that the government is not bringing any additional charges pursuant to the plea agreement the way it normally would?
No, normally the way the judgment is structured, it specifies, like, there's the line where you write in such charges were dismissed by right. oral motion of the government. Because there weren't any charges dismissed, that box wasn't checked.
Okay, so in your view, the judgment is consistent with the plea agreement?
Yes.
Okay.
In our view, it is consistent with the plea agreement. And I would certainly also suggest, Your Honors, that if, for example, we had failed to move for the third point of acceptance of responsibility, or if all of a sudden we decided we wanted to bring related charges, I would submit to you that the defendant would be arguing that this is a binding plea agreement, and we cannot do that. Nor would we, because we believe that this is a binding plea agreement and that its terms are effective on both parties in all respects. And we're simply asking for the benefit of our bargain. The defendant agreed to waive his right to appeal, and we want him to be held to that. If Your Honors would like, I can turn to the sentencing issues very briefly. We think that the district judge provided a very individualized and thoughtful sentencing of this defendant. The defendant's own brief acknowledges, if you look at pages 6 and 7 of the brief, and then also I believe around 12, it goes through some of the statements that the court made that were responsive to the defendant's arguments about military service, no criminal history, the rehabilitation efforts. Also, the court did discuss the number of images, the seriousness of the images. They were heinous. The court specifically said it is difficult to read. So although the court never said the 1,900 images of child pornography and 96 videos of child pornography were a small percentage of your overall collection, we think that that misses the mark. We think that the court responded to the heart of the defendant's argument there, which was an attempt to minimize the scope of the conduct. And the court responded to that. The court responded by saying, this is extremely serious. You have an enormous number of images. There were 57 known victims and countless more whose lives are forever changed by your conduct. Beyond that, the district judge specifically responded to the guidelines policy argument. The way that the defendant framed his argument about, he said that the guidelines were antiquated, and then he immediately goes into talking about how other judges in other districts have chosen to vary on this. And the court responded to that directly. The court said, I understand your argument about other judges varying for various reasons. I don't think that is appropriate here. And he goes on to say, which I think again reinforces the idea that this was a very individualized and thoughtful explanation. The judge goes on to say, each case is unique. Each case is an individual case with an individual judge who has to determine what sentence is sufficient but not greater than necessary for this person in light of all the 3553A factors. And then he went on to explain why he was not going as high as the government requested, nor was he going as low as the defendant requested. Instead, he was imposing a sentence at the bottom of the advisory guideline range.
Ms. Fritz, there's a question about this, and that is the question that Mr. Soloff was raised a question concerned that he was suffering from a mental situation, condition that was almost somewhat compulsory, pornographic, those type things, beyond just rehabilitation. But the whole idea that the mitigator was you had a fragile profile person who led him to be want to this type of behavior. Where did the court address that aspect of it? That's different than rehabilitation. This goes to the mind of the person before that in terms of whether or not it was an impulsive type of behavior based on a problem. Now, I didn't see where in the record that the court addressed that aspect of the argument. Can you tell me where and how, if he did?
I believe around page 113, the court does talk about how in his assessment, based on the defendant's intelligence, that he knew that what he was doing was wrong. So I think that that is an awareness of the wrongfulness of his conduct and his decision to nevertheless engage in the same conduct from 2000 through 2017. This wasn't an aberrant period. The rehabilitation did not start until after he was caught. And the court was convinced that the defendant knew his conduct was wrong.
He doesn't have to reach the McNaughton rule in terms of not knowing the difference between right and wrong for at this stage to consider a mitigator that he had problems that led to this being of a somewhat impulsive, if not directly compulsive, behavior. That was his argument, and that doesn't seem to be frivolous. People very intelligent can be under these type of situations with pornographic material and other things like that. But that's a different question, whether or not he would reach the sense of right and wrong. You can know that very well, but still have some compulsion, like a person who may be, for example, not this case, but schizophrenic, for example. They could very well know their behavior, but because of their malady, they want to do those things, and they're asking for that to be considered when you decide what the sentence should be. That's what a mitigator, that's an individualized thing. That's different than somebody who's never been having a problem before, they go to rehabilitation. This, his argument was before this. This was consistent with his thing that he was dealing with. And then you're right, maybe it was being arrested and convicted, and this led him to rehabilitation, but that doesn't address his anti-charge and where he was, how was that? I don't see where he addressed that. You're right, he certainly did. He said, you're a very smart person. You're intelligent, you knew what you were doing. This is horrible, that's right. But that's why we look at non-frivolous mitigators. And you're right, this case is fraught with all kinds of situations where it was horrible pornographic material, you know, where we don't even want to talk about it. But the question is, I just don't see where the court addressed that. But that's what you said, address that.
If I may add to that, I think that we have a combination, obviously, of the court acknowledging his intelligence and his awareness of it being wrong. I think later on that same page, however, the court does note that there were gaps in his collection of child pornography. You have activity from 2000 to 2002, and he goes through and he acknowledges that there were gaps. So to the extent that I think that although the defendant had engaged in this conduct over a very long period of time, the record reflects that there were gaps, which would run counter to the idea that this was, that the child pornography collection was a compulsion that he was unable to manage. And we believe that a 151-month sentence was absolutely procedurally and substantively reasonable. However, we would ask the court not to reach that issue and instead find that the plea agreement was binding on both parties, accepted by the court, and dismiss this appeal pursuant to the plea agreement.
Thank you, Ms. Fritz.
Thank you.
Mr. Howard, you have some time reserved. Mr. Howard? Are you muted, Mr. Howard? You have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Am I loud and clear now, yeah. Sir?
Yes.
Yeah, you're good. You're good.
I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this question before you start off. Let me ask this question. You know, it seemed to me, we've said countless times in terms of Fourth Circuit jurisprudence, a plea agreement in terms of enforcement is a contract between the government and the defendant. It's in contract terms. And there's nothing that said that there wasn't a meeting of the minds at any way in this contract, and you don't challenge that. You only challenge what seemed to be that it was not ratified by the court, which means formally accepting it. Well, if that's the case, your argument is, then basically you're saying that the whole thing is off. You can't cherry pick it. That means I get to the provision that says no waiver, that falls away. I get a chance to appeal these things. No, wouldn't it be like, as I kind of understood Ms. Fritz was saying, with course, she doesn't want this to be the result, but she said if that wins the day, then the whole thing is off. And it works on both sides. That means that your client doesn't have a plea agreement at all now because it wasn't ratified, if that's the case, because this is a contract between you. And if ratification is necessary to that degree, then somehow there's no contract. You can't, otherwise, you can't, okay, there's no contract now. I want that provision, but I want this one. I want that one. Can you address that? How can you, it seems like you're having your, trying to have your cake and eat it too.
Your Honor, we are absolutely running that risk. We believe that the court failed to endorse and accept the plea agreement. We believe that as a result, you are empowered then to examine the procedural substance of the reasonableness of the and towards those two points, if I may, sir, I would just say,
well, why should we examine something that's an illegal plea? No, we go back and say your client can then exercise the rights to plead not guilty, have witness come before them and do all of those things. Why would we do that?
Well,
why do we take that? Why would we do that? Why would we cherry pick your contract? If you prevail, then you have no contract. There's no plea agreement. That's between you and the government. I mean, that would be, that's a little judicial activism in it. We're going to say, the district court failed to ratify it. Therefore, we're going to let you decide which part of what provisions of the contract that doesn't exist now would be enforced. That seems to be inconsistent.
Well, Your Honor, we just believe that the issue before this court right now is the waiver effective? And it's effective if the district court accepted it, but it didn't. And as a result, the waiver is.
I have one question. I understand. You understand? Are you saying on the record you don't mind risking that your client would go back with no plea agreement, and you just go back to pleading guilty or not guilty at his choice? Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's the risk we run because we believe a substantively and procedurally reasonable sentence would be a better outcome for him.
Well, but to follow up on what Judge Gregory said, you leave yourself open for getting a much bigger sentence that we would still, that the district court would conclude is appropriate and we would affirm. So, I mean, looking at sort of all of the risks here, you still are pursuing this argument, right?
Your Honor, he's serving about 12 and a half years. He did not manufacture. I'm not terribly concerned about worst case scenarios. I would love for a district court to give us the honor of more fully explaining his response to the significant rehabilitation effort of this defendant. That was the central thesis of his sentencing argument, and not responding to the central thesis is what this court held in 2020 in United States versus Lewis that required.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I'm just having a little trouble hearing you. Did you say that his exceptional rehabilitation and recovery was the central thrust of his argument? And then what did you say after that?
Yes, Your Honor, it's the central thesis because I've taken that from this court's opinion, and I can see you don't hear me that well, so I'll get closer. Is that helping?
Yes, thank you.
This court held in 2020 in the United States versus Lewis that where a district court failed to respond to the central thesis of a defense mitigation argument, it needed to be vacated.
And can I ask you a question? I just want to stop you there and ask for a clarification. So that is also how I read both the district court transcript and your brief, that the thrust of this mitigation argument was about the concededly very exceptional rehabilitation and recovery efforts. Was there a separate argument made either before the district court or in your brief on appeal that put to one side the recovery and the rehabilitation, just the argument that Judge Gregory was outlining, put that to one side? This is the product of a mental issue and a compulsion, and the sentence ought to reflect that as well. because I don't see that as a separate argument before the district court. But if there is somewhere where it exists, I would like to know.
We would suggest that's implicit in the rehabilitation efforts that are made. The court referred to it as him being sober. And that, I guess, is an appropriate term. This, it's not an adequate response, we would suggest, to the extent of rehabilitation he had undergone.
I gotcha. So it's sort of implicit he needed the rehabilitation and the recovery because there was a problem.
Yes, Your Honor. And finally, if I may, we would just point out that pre-sentence court is statutorily mandated to any felon. It happens by operation of law, whether there's a plea agreement or not. So the court's reference to the plea to the PSR calculations is something that must happen because they have to determine the advisory guideline range. But it's not necessarily, or by any stretch of the imagination, evidence that the court has accepted the plea agreement. And with that, thank you very much, and we would close.
Thank you so much, Mr. Howard, Ms. Fritz. We appreciate your arguments. We're sorry we can't come down and greet you personally, but know nonetheless we're very appreciative of your fine work and your efforts. Thank you for your arguments. Be safe and stay well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.